as a fire filled the air. Madmen ran everywhere in that big Ohio prison tragedy.
Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. That's a bit from Ohio Prison Fire by Bob Miller. It's a song that describes the horrific fire in 1930 that claimed the lives of more than 300 inmates at the Ohio Penitentiary. The Ohio Pen by then had a grim reputation and was known for poor conditions. It was also the site of hundreds of executions, first by the gallows and later by the electric chair. Joining us now to dig deeper into the history of the Ohio Penitentiary are two of three co-authors of a new book on the topic, Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. David Myers has joined us on the program for two other books, Ohio Jazz, A History of Jazz in the Buckeye State, and the award-winning Look to Lazarus, The Big Store. Welcome back, David.
Hi, Ann.
And also joining us, James Daly of Kettering. He's a curator of the largest private collection of Ohio prison memorabilia and also a co-author of the book. Welcome to the show, James.
Morning.
So, for the record, we should just say the Ohio Penitentiary was built in 1934 and was actually the state's second state prison. It was closed in 1984. That's an amazing span of time to me.
Yes, it is, because there are parts of it that remain pretty much unchanged throughout its history. And that was one of the problems, is that, you know, when it was built, it was heralded as you know, one of the greatest prison structures in the country. And people came to marvel at it. You know, it was a reflection of, you know, it was the cutting edge for penology at the time. And then Ohio had a tendency to do this. We'd build these magnificent institutions and then just continue to use them way beyond their lifespan.
Sort of resting on the laurels of,
yeah.
So what was it like? How big was it? What was it made of?
Well, it was made of limestone primarily, but it was, you know, it's 23 acres enclosed, you know, downtown area. It was out kind of in the countryside at the time it was built. And we have one picture in a book of a cow in front of it. But it was, you know, a standard prison. It was mostly walls and cell blocks and factories, especially, you know, during its early years when they had the contract system where private businesses would come in and actually build factories within the walls and use the inmates as labor.
Yeah, you refer to it as the abominable contract system of the prison shop. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
It's, you know, I'm not the only one that calls it that.
Okay.
And the reason being is that it was really exploitive. The prisoners were mistreated by the contractors, you know, worse than they would have been by prison officials. And there, you know, this was a time when you didn't have any workman comp benefits or anything, and people were always getting maimed and, you know, worked pretty much to death for a pittance. And but even though it was exploitative in that fashion, and the inmates looked forward to that money because that's what they used in order to improve their living conditions. So they if they didn't get overtime, they were upset about it.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests this hour, David Myers and also James Daly, they are co-authors, two of three authors of a new book. It's called Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. I guess I think I made a mistake. I said the prison was built in 1934. It was built in 1834.
Yes.
So sorry about that. It always had a bad reputation, a cholera epidemic, the worst criminals, that horrible fire. Why is that? Because it wasn't just with the aging of the prison that came along.
Well, I wouldn't say it was always a bad reputation.
Okay.
People were proud of it when it was built.
Okay.
I mean, it was a showcase. But, you know, it wasn't long after that you did have the cholera epidemic. Bad things happen when you put a lot of people together in a very congested area. And that was, you know, things happened in prison. One of the themes, you know, of anything I've written regarding prisons has been that we take these institutions, build them for a specific purpose, and then we pack as many people of them into them as we can. And as a result, any programming, you know, any attempt at, you know, rehabilitation is lost because you're just dealing with bodies at that point.
And so, yeah, it was built for 1,500 inmates, and at its high, at its high number, it was over 5,000.
Correct.
In 1930, there were 4,300 prisoners there. That was the year that of the fire, was that related to construction that was going on to expand the prison, James?
They were improving, updating cells, putting...
air conditioning?
Not air conditioning, but toilets, stuff like that. And fire wasn't a big thing they worried about in the, you know, limestone prison. You know, there'd occasionally be little fires, you know, smoking out bed bugs and stuff, but there was really no way for it to spread. But during the time of the Easter Monday fire, there, with the construction going on, there was a lot of wooden forms soaked in oil, you know, and the entire length of the roof was wood. So when the fire did spread, it spread quickly, and the length of the cell block. And another interesting note on that is the before that cell block was built, it was the grounds for the prison cemetery. So kind of an eerie coincidence, if you will.
And also another coincidence, the siege, the 12-day siege of the prison down in
Lucasville.
Lucasville,
yes.
Occurred over Easter weekend. It just occurred to me.
Yeah.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We're talking about the Ohio Penitentiary with two of the three authors of a new book. It's called Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. So there was, I was wondering, after the fire, what was left of the prison? And James Daly, do you have any remnants from pre-fire?
As in artifacts?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely have some things that were pre-fire, you know. I have, you know, a booklet from, I think, 1854, and on the cover is a man in a top hat. It's a woodcut with a cat of nine hitting a prisoner, and badges and things of that nature, and keys.
There's a lot of things were made by inmates too, and I'm not sure how far those some of those precede 1930.
What sort of things did they make?
Well, I've got a couple items that were made for different governors, Myers Cooper during the governor that investigated the fire. I've got some items that sat on his desk, because obviously he was a Republican governor, so he collected elephants. And it's a case with his name engraved on it, a glass and wood case, and inside are little bone elephants and that are carved. And, you know, the inmates would use the license plate press to fashion pennies to stamp them.
Wait a minute. Let's go back to the bone.
Oh, yes.
Bones
yes.
From what?
I'd assume they probably came from cow bones in the kitchen.
Okay. Yeah. You know? Just checking. Yeah.
But that's not the only bone thing I have from there. An item made for another governor is a little match safe, and on one side of it is carved the Ohio governor at the time, Davy, and on the other side is President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And, you know, it's got the inmate's number on it, but that was all, you know. And then there's other intricate carvings of angels on it. And I went to the Historical Society here and looked through their logbooks, and I was just simply looking for the number, which wasn't in any order. So for 5 hours, I sat there and just skimmed numbers and finally found, I almost screamed in the library, which I think they looked down upon then.
I don't know, but you found something important, and who was it? Anybody? Just a guy?
But the thing is, that finding, I don't recall
making
his name.
Making that connection?
Because then that just opens, his entire history then is in that piece.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes for every single thing I put together that, you know, it's not just an item, an object. It's somebody's life is locked in it, you know, and together, you know, it's like a whole world comes into view, you know, just throughout the eras. And it's like a big puzzle, you know, that's always being put together.
You know, one of the fascinating things about working at the Ohio Penitentiary is you had so many things that were made by the inmates, and they had very intricately carved furniture, you know, and they'd have, you know, leaves and the seal of Ohio and all the stuff that they had carved into it. And it was just magnificent stuff. And, you know, a lot of that was lost in the fire. But even when I was working there in 72 and 73, we still had some antique furniture in our offices.
Going back to the fire real quick, there was an investigation. What started the fire, and what did they come up with in the investigation?
Do you want to take that,
Daly?
Yeah, there was... it was actually an escaped attempt. A handful of inmates were kind of lit a fuse with oil and kerosene, and they expected this candle to ignite while they were all at dinner, and amidst the confusion, they would escape. Well, it took too long for it to ignite, and everybody was locked back in their cells, and...
It was just a diversion.
Right.
You know, it failed miserably.
Right. And it said, I mean, they were locked in their cells and there were guards there who would not let them out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the warden himself just simply thought it was an escaped attempt, went to the street and, you know, ordered shoot to kill if anybody tries to escape, you know, rather than try to, you know, implement some sort of rescue operation.
And then a riot started.
Well, yeah. I mean, you had basically, in the aftermath of the fire, you had inmates taking over areas. But, you know, the fire itself was almost a riot.
I was going to say the riot was maybe confused with panic from a fire.
You had people trying to do whatever they could to save, you know, their fellow inmates, you know, largely. And the whole thing was that the warden didn't take it all that seriously, and he delayed, you know, contacting the local fire department. He thought the inmate fire department could handle it, and there was all kinds of mismanagement took place, mm-hmm. and you know, there was an investigation of that afterwards, and somehow he managed to hold on to his job. But, yeah, I mean, everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Now, like I said earlier, there were 4,300 prisoners in there in a place built for 1,500, and— the fires did lead to the overcrowding was horrible, and the fire did lead to changes in state minimum sentencing, and the parole board was created the next year to address maybe just the overcrowding in general.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a lesson to a lot of people, but it wasn't a lesson that everybody learned, and the overcrowding soon resumed. It was, you know, a horrible prison fire. It's still the worst in the United States. I think there's been worse fires elsewhere, prison fires. But that's one of the things that, you know, repeatedly we have these opportunities to learn, and we seldom do, you know. And we had the 1952 riot. Well, that should have prepared us better for 1968. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. That should have prepared us for Lucasville. You know, it's... we just failed to learn. We learned some, but not enough.
To what extent do you think that it happened at the top of the Depression? And
you mean there's a factor in it?
Yes.
I think that was probably one of the reasons for the overcrowding. Mm-hmm. I don't know that, you know, the fire itself is that it was intentionally set and just
right.
Some bad decisions made after that, but...
We are talking with David Myers and James Daly. They are two of three co-authors of Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. And if you're dying to know, the third is Elise Myers. We will continue our conversation about the Ohio Penitentiary when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is a bit from the song Gallows Pole by American folk and blues legend Lead Belly to follow the theme of our show today, which is about the Ohio Penitentiary, the one that doesn't take up the Riverside downtown anymore. It was brought down in 1990, in August 1990. They all actually the then mayor Buck Reinhart started to take it down with a wrecking ball. And that was, they put the kibosh on that, at least temporarily. Tell me what happened.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I went to work at the Iowa Penitentiary in 1972 in the psychology department and was there in 73 when they announced they were closing it. And they did make an effort to close the prison. They basically closed down everything except the hospital at that time. But they maintained the hospital then for a number of years. And it seemed like, despite their best intentions to close it because Lucasville was opening up, they just couldn't close it. And so it had a number of false closing dates. And you end up where the Buck Reinhart, you know, we've got this empty facility then. He decides that as mayor of Columbus, he wants to tear this thing down to redevelop the site. And he famously
wants to tear it down.
he famously got behind the wrecking ball and started knocking down the small front of it, and only to learn that they didn't have possession of it yet, and they didn't have the right to tear it down. So it resulted in some fines, and they had to reconstruct some of the things that were damaged. But eventually he was able to bring it down. And what aided that is they had part of the wall collapsed on Neal Avenue.
Crushed a car, yes.
So even though we had a 25-foot wall, it looked really imposing. When you neglect anything like that, you know, water gets in and we have, you know, ice freezes it and breaks it loose, and this huge wall just collapsed. So eventually they were able to tear it down and they built the Arena District in its place.
My guests are David Myers and James Daly II. They're both co-authors of Inside the Penitentiary. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. William in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, William.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I have a two-part question. One, over the course of years with that prison, what were the demographics relative to ethnicity and gender that were housed at that prison? And the second part was, what was the range of length of sentences? Were they longer in the beginning, shorter at the end? Or did the sentencing and penalty times change as time changed?
Okay. David Myers, you want to take a swat at that?
I'll take the first
150-year history, things changed,
yes.
I would imagine.
And one of the things, you know, we pointed out in the book, which people are kind of amazed at, is when they built the penitentiary, it was for everybody, men, women, and children. And they didn't have separate facilities at that time. And they eventually made a women's annex to separate the women out. And they built the Boys Industrial School, Ohio State Reformatory, or not Ohio State Reformatory, but Boys Industrial School, Ohio State Farm in Lancaster to take away the juveniles. But so the age varied. Basically, Ohio State Reformatory for much of its life was the maximum security facility in Ohio. You had Ohio State Reformatory, which was for younger, first-time offender, young adults. Ohio Penitentiary is for anything that was more serious than that. Sentences could run from a year to life. From a demographic standpoint, there was always a disproportionate number of minorities in that, you know, disproportionate compared to the population, mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons. As I said, you know, gender, we did have women there at the beginning. Later on, they would, you know, we had three women that were executed in the electric chair. They were brought back to the prison for that purpose. So anything you'd want to add to that, James?
Well, in the book, we even included an engraving of a woman with her child that she cared for in the prison.
The women's annex was a kind of a separate world,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they had carpets on the floor and things like that.
A little bit nicer?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the women was Sarah Jackson. She wrote her autobiography, and they had this in the autobiography, they had this engraving of her in her cell. And there's a poster on the back wall that says Columbus, which I think is really funny. It's like a travel poster, you know. She has if you go beyond the wall.
she took some pride in it. Yes. And I know of one lady that actually had a bearskin rug in her cell. She was a con artist that pretended she was Andrew Carnegie's illegitimate daughter.
Chadwick, yes.
Yeah, she ended up shutting down banks in Cleveland by the time she was caught, but... She ended up passing away in the prison, a broken woman.
Yeah, we actually have a chapter in the book that's about prison women. And it's about those who were confined there, but also a lot of it is about Preston Thomas, the warden during the fire, his daughter Amanda, who grew up in the prison, basically. Mm-hmm. And when she was a co-ed at Ohio State, he went away to a conference, I think, in Kansas City and left her in charge of the prison.
Well, those were the good old days.
Yes.
William, thanks a lot for your call. Helen in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to talk a little bit more about the fire? Welcome.
Yeah, I do. Thank you. How many kids perished in the fire was question number one. And question number two, what government or high-level officials profited from the prison?
Two very different questions. Okay, well, first let's talk about how many kids perished in the fire.
Well, I think the final number was 322.
Those aren't kids.
People,
yeah,
though.
Yeah.
People. And a lot of them, I know of one case where there were four brothers and two of them perished.
Yeah, there weren't any kids per se there at the time. There might have been, you know,
some
teenagers at the time, but there weren't any kids.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Helen. She asked about people profiting from the prison. We've already talked about the contract or the
that was
contract
one,
labor.
I mean, basically, the warden position for much of the prison's history was a political spoils position. And that's why you had wardens who were notoriously bad still able to hang on to the position. It was a way of they could profit from it because, you know, you were in charge, managed this large labor force.
Kind of like Shawshank?
Yeah, somewhat.
Yeah. And money in the pies.
Yeah, and so you had those kind of things going on. What I found interesting is that it was a desirable place to work, and every county was allocated one guard position. So if you were from Auglaize County, you know, you would talk to your local politician if you wanted to become the guard at the Ohio Penitentiary representing Auglaize County.
Well, I mean, prison positions long have been considered pretty good state jobs until they started privatizing the prisons and conditions changed. You both have a link to the prison system. David, you worked there for the system for about 30 years, including a couple years.
Adult and juvenile prisons.
Right, adult and juvenile, including a couple years in actually the Ohio Penitentiary.
Yes. Yeah, when I got there in 72, the death penalty had just been overturned, and I worked in the psychology department as a psychologist. And one of the jobs I had was evaluating those being released from death row, because for the first time since they had been admitted, they actually had the prospect of maybe actually being paroled at some point. And most of them were then. So you had people that, you know, believed every day that they were going to die, and now they knew that they had a good chance of getting out. So it was interesting evaluating that.
An interesting transitional time. And, Derek, you served for a time in Lima Correctional Institution, and I thought that was kind of an interesting insight that you bring to this project, not only your collection of Ohio prison memorabilia, which is the largest private collection of Ohio prison memorabilia in the world, but also you were behind bars there, and I wonder if you guys could talk about the collaboration, how you found each other and how you decided to collaborate on this book.
Well, David and Elise have previously written a book called Central Ohio's Historic Prisons, and, you know, I thought I'd see if they had turned up anything, you know, and made some good contacts, so I invited them over the house and showed them everything, and we had a great conversation, talked for a while, and apparently I have a flair for the dramatic. So after, you know, we had spoken, I handed him my prison ID card, you know, which kind of turned things on its head for a minute, just because I think, you know, there is a stigma, you know, if somebody tells you, oh, I've been in prison, I mean, even me, my general reaction is, you know, one of skepticism. But especially when it comes to dealing with people that are in law enforcement, you know, they are definitely trained to have that skepticism. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm not naturally drawn to ex-inmates.
And then you,
but my daughter and I had this discussion as we were driving there that this was a possibility because we didn't know anything about him at the time.
And, oh, really? You actually?
Yeah, and that was a lesson I learned at my first job in prison. I got graduated from college, went to the Ohio State Reformatory, working in the psychology department there, and the first thing I learned from the inmates is, "What's your angle?" It's a question you should ask whenever you encounter anybody. And I get contacted by James out of the blue. He's interested. And from what little I knew about him, I didn't think he was a former prison employee. And so my question is, what's his angle? My mental question I didn't ask him. But, you know, I'm not drawn to former inmates naturally. But James is a terrific guy. I'll vouch for him. And there's been a few others that I've become friends with over the years.
Lots of people who've served time.
That's one of the points of the book too. Famous
movie stars and millionaires have served time. So
that doesn't vouch for their character itself.
True.
But the high idea that almost all of them get out. Almost all inmates get out. They're around us. No, the advantage we have when you work in a prison is you know who they are. When you're out in the streets, you don't. People that kind of recoil from having any kind of an interaction, you're probably already interacting with somebody that has served time for something. And, you know, hopefully most of them have reformed. Like,
I would love to have heard some of your conversations that you had in writing the book as you were researching it and preparing it. Coming from the psychological point of view, coming from the experience that you had, James Daly, it must have been interesting to sort of ponder what they were thinking and doing and
I think
talking
the story
about at the
that,
time.
That we're probably most divided on is about Julius Krauss. From perspective, because he and I see it a little bit differently. And Julius, this is a story I wasn't aware of, and it's a fabulous story, so I'll let James tell it. But my take on it's a little bit different than his is. So you want to go ahead?
James Daly?
Well, I came across a mugshot of a man that had a $50 reward on his head. And so I did a little bit of research into that specific card, and I found out that this man had been arrested for being complicit in a murder 10 years prior to his escape. And then I found out that when he escaped, he actually went and found the quote-unquote real killer. And they turned themselves in. And I tend to lean towards, you know, that he was innocent the whole time, you know. It's a gray area. I can't really form a definite opinion on it one way or the other. But ended up serving like 11 more years after, you know, another man confessed to the crime he was convicted of. But there's more to this story.
But others were skeptical like you are?
I think that he had some involvement in it. It wasn't direct, but I think he had some involvement in it. But I think James tends to identify with Julius Krauss because Julius has artistic skills that developed. He became... the famous artist thing program came out while he was in prison, and he was given a free scholarship by the people that are head of famous artists, and went on to become an artist after he was released from prison. And James is also a very good artist. That's how he makes his living. And so I think there's some, you know, the idea that, you know, James didn't commit any murders, but the idea of being able to reform and to, you know, prove yourself. I mean, I think that's what he's always looking for when he comes across.
There's another great story about that that I wanted you to talk about. If I can dig it up, it's O. Henry served in the penitentiary, and he was a great writer, but he was also a pharmacist.
Yes,
he
was.
Interesting story about him.
You know, served him well once he got to prison.
Yeah.
O. Henry basically, prior to going to prison, he had some problems with alcohol, and he'd held a number of different jobs. He'd worked in pharmacies and things, ended up in banking, was accused of embezzlement, and that's what sent him to prison. There's a question of whether he actually did embezzle or the bookkeeping was just sloppy. Yeah. But he ends up at the Ohio Penitentiary. And that's where he kind of invents himself as a writer. And, a lot of the things he observed in the prison became kind of grist for his story writing skills. And but our best account of him is in the writings of Al Jennings, who was a lawyer turned train robber, bad train robber, who was also at the Ohio Penitentiary and apparently was a friend of O'Henry's prior when he was on the run prior to coming to the penitentiary. So they resumed their friendship, and then they continued the friendship after they left. But he attributes all kinds of things to O'Henry and describes all these experiences. And we debunk some of those in the book because they couldn't have happened the way Al Jennings said. And so Al Jennings was a guy who was very much a self-aggrandizer and puts himself in the center of everything. And I think he freely adapted things from other people's lives and put into them in his own and included in his biography of Henry.
Well, I don't want to torture people by going to a break before I mention this, but I had to say there was a lot of that, not just by people like him, but by newspaper reporters. Not self-aggrandizing, but just blowing up stories out of proportion, like the vampire story.
The vampire story.
Okay,
yes.
Well, we'll come back to that when we return. We'll get to some calls and emails. If you want to give us a call and have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, if they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's Folsom Prison Blues, a song written and recorded by American country music star Johnny Cash, of course, enhancing the theme of our program today, which is about the Ohio Penitentiary. In the studio with me, David Myers and James Daly II, two of three co-authors of a new book. It's called Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We brought up the issue of the vampire. I guess we should, finish the story. The first known vampire.
it's a complicated story. I'd read across references to him, and the thing is, this guy's name was James Brown, and he was a Portuguese fisherman. And in 1866, he was on this ship, the Atlantic, and he murdered a guy. They got in an argument and stabbed him. And as a result, he was arrested and brought back to the United States and tried and sentenced to prison in Massachusetts. And eventually, he ended up at the Ohio Penitentiary, and that was in 1889. And he spent 3 years here. And when he was released, he was identified as being a vampire. And there's been several books that have had chapters about James Brown in them. And what I found interesting is all the accounts were drawn from newspaper sources from like New York City and things. And so I decided, well, what did the local newspapers have to say? And I found that actually these were just re-reporting of the stories in the Columbus papers. And that what happened is, I think that some enterprising journalists locally must have been a slow news day and decided to see if they could outdo each other. and basically made up these stories out of not whole cloth, but pretty much whole cloth, where, you know, you had the number of murders he committed increase, that he killed people in the other prisons, that, you know, he was killing stray cats in the prison and drinking their blood, that, you know, he was on the boat, that he had, you know, drunk blood out of the skull of one. I mean, it just goes crazy.
I think the term David used was a cloven skull he was drinking from.
Yeah, that's what it said. Yeah. And so but this has been widely reported as, you know, Charles Fort, who, you know, chronicled all the strange stuff, identified him, you know, as America's first reported vampire.
Well, I was curious about the word first, as if there's been a second and a third identified.
I mean, people are always looking for vampires nowadays, aren't they?
Right.
And so there's an attempt to explain this by trying to tie him to other people named Brown who strange things happened. They dug up the graves and the people had decayed and that kind of stuff. So
okay.
It's a very convoluted story, but the source seems to be Columbus.
Derek in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about those 1968 riots.
Yes, I wanted them to talk a little bit about the 1968 riots, and I wanted to know, did they come across about a 1972 Columbus Dispatch article on the release of the death row inmates, who in fact they had pictures of all the inmates on death row at that time? Did they come across that article? Yes.
I remember the article, and the reason I remember it is because they had photos in the article, and I knew some of those guys because I had done the evaluations on them. There was one in particular that was interesting because I knew him pretty well. And he was out, and he was making a fairly successful career as a salesman, I understand. As far as the 68 riots are concerned, you know, we've got a chapter on that in the book. I kind of had a personal connection to that because I was working summers for a local contractor, a highway contractor, V.N. Holderman and Sons. And I worked on a survey crew, and the party chief was a National Guardsman. And when he got called up, I think he was a sergeant, I had to drive him down to the prison to drop him off so he could report for duty. So I had kind of a close up experience with it. But I remember I started working there, I said, in 72. And one of the stories that came out of that, which we don't talk about in the book, is my boss was a psychologist at the prison, and he had compiled all of his research for his PhD thesis, and they had burned the psychology department, and all of his research burned up, so he had to repeat it all.
614-292-DEREK, by the way, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question for my guests, David Myers and James Daly II. They are two of three co-authors of Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. It's a new book out. We have an email from Bob. He asks, do your guests have an opinion about whether a portion of the Ohio Penitentiary could have been preserved and open to the public? There is a billboard on High Street advertising the original Mansfield Reformatory as a tourist attraction. Every time I see it, I wonder why something similar couldn't have been done in Columbus. James Daly, any thoughts about that?
I think that at least the front facade, the front.
Which was kind of cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, history is a renewable resource. You know, that's always going to draw people. And I think it could have been integrated into the site itself, you know. Mm-hmm. And with only saving the front building, it would have been a lot easier to maintain. And then whenever one of these stories came up, you know, more interest would have been drawn to the site.
Yeah, what I would like to have seen done, and I pointed this out to people, if you ever go to Aruba, there's three islands, Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao, the ABC islands. Curaçao has a port, and when you come into it, there's a fortress on the left side. And it's been preserved, but it's also a modern hotel and a marketplace. So they kept the outer shell and built this, you know, new complex in it. And I would have liked to have seen something like that done just to preserve, you know, the external appearance of it. And maybe, you know, you could keep a jail cell or a prison cell or something for people to see. But I think it's important not to keep burying our past because, you know, as I say, you know, if you forget the past, then you relive it.
Buck Reinhart, mayor at the time, who took the wrecking ball to it and so forth after a time, regretted the complete demolition and thought that they should save some of
correct,
it.
Correct. And I think there was a lot of sentiment for that. But the problem is, by that time, you know, it was falling apart. It had been neglected mm-hmm. too long. And it takes money to do that kind of thing. And there wasn't any money forthcoming for it.
And the Ohio Historical Society, I mean, there weren't any preservationists out there that were fighting to keep it?
There were preservationists, yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of things to fight for, so you got to choose your battles. I mean, the Ohio State Reformatory is more of a fluke that it's been saved to the extent it has because you don't have a city like Columbus growing
up around
it. In Mansfield,
you mean?
Yeah. In Mansfield, you know, there isn't as much demand for that space as there is in Columbus.
Roberta, you're on the air. Roberta from Columbus?
Yes. Hi.
Okay, thanks.
My question is, it sounds like genocide to me. The prisoners would either...
I'm sorry, what sounds like genocide to you?
With the warden refusing to even, you know, try to rescue the people, the prisoners.
Oh, you're talking about the fire. Okay.
Yeah.
The fire back in 1930
right.
that killed about 300 people, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I'd call it genocide because that, you know, would be a deliberate act. I just think they weren't prepared. That, you know, they didn't have fire drills. They didn't have the fear there, you know.
Yeah, the warden said, they asked about his fire plan. He said, well, I just thought we'd use common sense. And
okay.
clearly it was lacking that day.
Saying calling it genocide would give him too much credit for
yeah.
thinking.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that would be a deliberate
yeah.
act of murder.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't go that far.
But
okay.
Clearly there was negligence. But as I said, he managed to hold on to his job despite an investigation.
All right. Roberta, thanks for the call. Pam in Wapakoneta, you're on the air. Welcome, Pam.
Hi. This question is for James. James, what was the first piece you acquired in reference to the Ohio Penitentiary, and what is the most fascinating?
The first piece from the Ohio Penitentiary. You know, I'm not sure of the thousands of pieces.
Well,
what's
the most fascinating? Maybe that's a.
That probably changes by the day, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's always growing. I mean, I have a cell door in my kitchen that kind of shocked David when he came over.
Weird.
They're heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you get the stuff from?
From all over. I think I'm really hoping the book itself will show people that, you know, because there's a lot of people that had connections, whether they had people that work there or, you know, maybe took a field trip and collected something.
Okay.
And rather than get lost to history, you know, like I said, the stories are what give each piece life. And, you know, as these things get sold at garage sales and the story, you know, the life in them kind of just evaporates. So I'm always looking for more stuff to...
Where do you go? Do you go to antique stores? Do you go to...
Really anywhere. Like Columbus is a good spot to look, and you know
anywhere in Columbus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's not just the Ohio Penitentiary. It's
uh-huh.
It's like the Lima State Hospital. And an early piece I got from there was that was the prison I was at. I have a letter from the governor stating that it's ready to start receiving patients. Like in, you know, I don't know if it was 1907 or something, mm-hmm. but. And I even have the architect's personal family photo albums, and I know he's well known in Columbus, Frank L. Packard. He did a lot of work in Columbus, and
yeah.
you know
he'll go anywhere
yeah.
to add things to his collection.
Yeah.
I was kind of kidding, changes by the day, but every time I see him, he's got something new that's really fascinating. That you know, I think the most fascinating thing is the thing he doesn't have yet.
Yeah,
yeah, because it always ratchets up, you know. Each piece adds to the next, and you know, it's really not about me. The whole, you know, it's just I feel like I'm just a caretaker, you know, and I realize how important. Like I said, I feel like I have people's lives in my hands,
mm-hmm.
you know, and. So I think I grant people
yeah.
sort of immortality by
yeah.
preserving them. And like
yeah, Elise and I hadn't planned to do another prison book. But after we met James and saw his collection, we this needs exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can offer you the, you know, exposure through doing a book together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use, you know, a lot of his images and things in the book to show, but so it's only, you know, a small fraction of what he actually has.
Right. There were a lot of photographs in, used in the book that were taken a certain way, stereograph.
Yes.
That you're an expert in, you know about it, or you were able to use them and reproduce them in a way that...
Yeah, I actually, you know, I'm a stereo view photographer
stereo
myself.
View. Okay.
And the interesting thing about these, see, it's kind of a forgotten art. When movies came out, they died out. But prior to that, for entertainment, people would sit around their parlors and, you know, look at the Sphinx and see it in 3D, you know, which is another interesting thing about the Ohio Penitentiary. I have, I'm not sure, I think about 25 or so. And what's interesting about it is you're looking at these cards and you're kind of seeing the ghost of the penitentiary in 3D. You know, so you're seeing a building that's not there anymore, you know, the, you know, with horse and buggies outside, you know, and
you know, what's odd?
Go ahead.
So what's odd is the only other person I know that takes 3D pictures is my daughter. And so we've got this connection, too. But, you know, the cover I wanted to point out is, you know, of an inmate in the electric chair. And this is part of a stereo photo. And it's the only known photo of a stereo photo of a person in the electric chair,
and it
that's
is
from
ghostly.
James's collection.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's a very unsettling image.
And also another image in the book that I was intrigued by was the souvenir cards that were always updated to reflect the latest executions. That it's from your archives. It's kind of weird. Did they? What do you mean souvenir cards? Do people buy these?
25 cents. It's yours to bring home.
Yeah, a little more than 25 cents now.
Yeah. Are they rare now?
Generally, some are rarer than others. Some I've only seen once. Like the one in the book, that's the only one of those I've ever seen. And what's interesting is it's not featured in the book, but the back will have each inmate's name, his number, what county he's from, and who he murdered.
And there's an inset on this card, and it actually shows somebody being electrocuted.
Well, I'd say that was actually a stage scene.
Yeah, an illustration.
But yeah.
And, you know, it's the 25 cents for the card. Souvenirs. You know, touring the penitentiary was a big deal during that era. And a lot of the information we have comes from souvenir books that were written, you know, to sell to people. And, you know, there was a special charge. We talk about the demon's cage.
Yeah.
And how there's a special charge to see the people in the demon's cage. And there's a special charge to see the women's annex. And
so, even while people were there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's especially when they were there. Who would want to see them if they weren't there? I mean, but you're talking about opportunities to make money. Yeah, there were lots of opportunities to make money off the prison.
It was a different time. People viewed executions, just imprisonment, very differently.
Yeah, and a lot of it was entertainment in a way, like
exactly.
with the prior to the penitentiary, they had the they'd do the gallows and whatever county it was taking place in, and they'd be big events, you know, women and children and.
Yeah, we discussed that in the first chapter, the year Clark was hung, about the public hanging in Columbus, and you know, tens of thousands of people come to see it.
Well, there is lots to talk about this book. It's called Inside the Ohio Penitentiary. I've been talking with two of the three co-authors, David Myers and James Daly II, the third author, Elise Myers. All three authors will be appearing tonight at the Book Loft in German Village for a book signing. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. I want to thank my guests, David Myers, James Daly II. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.